Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On today's show, we'll feature a truth track, an audio documentary which hopes to rock hard as it seeks to inform, educate, and inspire. This week's truth track is entitled, The Possible Future of Video on the Internet. We'll also include a feature of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. Disability rights advocates sue the state of Illinois. A study connects climate change with increasingly intense storms. Citing the size of a massive lawsuit, Walmart requests a dismissal. The governor of Florida lifts a DNA testing deadline and issues new DNA testing rules. And a court rejects Alaska logging rules. Claiming that many developmentally disabled people have regressed and become less independent while living in institutional group homes, 9 Illinois residents are suing to force the state of Illinois to provide for care in integrated community settings, according to an announcement from the American Civil Liberties Union on the week of August 3, 2005. 3 advocacy groups joined the ACLU in filing a class action lawsuit to force the state to open up more community-based care settings. The suit was filed on behalf of the entire Illinois disabled community. Rights advocates say community-based settings provide the best living conditions for developmentally disabled people, a standard upheld by the Supreme Court in the case of Olmsted v. L.C., a 1999 decision widely hailed as a landmark affirmation of the rights of disabled persons. According to the lawsuit, Illinois is allegedly violating the Americans with Disabilities Act and federal Medicaid requirements by forcing many disabled residents into group homes where privacy is virtually non-existent and they are not allowed to choose fully for themselves what to wear, eat, or do. The filing calls on the court to force state health agencies to act faster to move people out of large institutions. A statement by the ACLU the day after the filing accuses the state of depriving disabled persons, quote, of their fundamental right to pursue meaningful and productive lives, unquote. The Illinois Department of Human Services is reviewing the lawsuit, according to the Chicago Tribune. Department spokesperson Tom Green said about 8,000 disabled people are currently in community-based settings and that the state was working on expanding the program. According to the lawsuit, over 6,000 developmentally disabled Illinois residents currently live in institutional group homes. A new analysis of hurricane intensity over the last 30 years adds to the growing evidence that rising global temperature is directly linked to increasing severe storm activity. The study, conducted by Massachusetts Institute of Technology Earth Sciences professor Kerry Emanuel and published in the journal Nature, found that a significant portion of the observed increase in tropical storm intensity derives from rising sea surface temperatures, an accepted measure of global warming. On average, duration and intensity of the storms have increased by 50% in the last 3 decades, according to the study. Emanuel's findings support earlier studies asserting a connection between human effects on climate change and storm intensity. It was funded by the National Science Foundation's Climate Dynamics Program, according to a report from the science news outlet PhysOrg.com. Just weeks after documents emerged revealing Walmart knew it was discriminating against women on its workforce but did nothing to address the problem, the world's largest retailer is seeking to end a pending class action lawsuit over alleged gender discrimination, complaining that the size of the plaintiff pool is too large. At a hearing scheduled for mid-August 2005, Walmart intends to argue that allowing 6 women to represent up to 1.6 million in the lawsuit will create an unwieldy situation that is unfair for the company, according to a report in the LA Times. According to company documents to be used against Walmart in the case, a 1998 report from an internal task force demonstrated a clear failure to promote women within the retail giant's ranks. Rather than act on the task force's recommendations, the documents reportedly show Walmart disbanded the diversity committee and did nothing. Initiated in 2001, Susan Dukes v. Walmart Stores charges the company with systematically discriminating against women in pay and promotion. A judge at the United States District Court for the Northern District of California certified the class action suit in June 2004, prompting Walmart to file a challenge with the appellate court, which will hear the arguments in August 2005. According to a 2003 study by a California-based consulting company, Drogen, Kakigi, and Associates, despite receiving better performance ratings, female Walmart workers have been paid and promoted at rates lower than their male counterparts have. Walmart claims it has reformed many of those practices and said 38% of its managers are now women. According to a statement on the company website, Walmart, quote, does not tolerate discrimination of any kind, close quote. Averting legislative gridlock, Florida Governor Jeb Bush signed an executive order lifting an October 1, 2005 deadline for state inmates seeking DNA tests to prove their innocence. The order bars state agencies from discarding DNA evidence without first notifying convicts and providing a 90-day window in which they can request the test. According to the Innocence Project, a nonprofit legal clinic providing post-conviction DNA testing services, mistaken identification is the most common reason for wrongful convictions, followed by intoxication and misconduct by police or prosecutors. Advocates for new death penalty rules and their allies in the state legislature are still pushing for a DNA testing law that would end evidence deadlines. State Senator Alex Villalobos, Republican from Miami, told the Miami Herald he intends to introduce new legislation to abolish the deadline soon. Governor Bush's new rules require the agencies possessing DNA evidence to send written notice to defendants, defense counsel, the prosecutor, and the state attorney general's office. A law allowing limited logging in an Alaskan national park is on the verge of dramatic change following an appeals court ruling in favor of a challenge brought by environmental groups in August 2005. The ruling found that too much lumber is being pulled from the Tongass National Park as a result of repeated decisions by the United States Forest Service not to expand preserved wilderness areas. The decision, made by the three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, is a step toward rolling back the park's deforestation. In 1997, Congress passed the Tongass Timber Reform Act, forcing federal land management officials to take market demand into account when crafting the Tongass National Park Land Management Plan. The measure governs recreation, conservation, tourism, and other factors affecting the 17-million-acre forest. But the court found that Forest Service officials misinterpreted the market demand for lumber, leading to numerous documented instances of felled trees rotting on the forest floor. According to the Anchorage Daily News, Forest Service officials failed to properly understand a market analysis and nearly doubled the amount of timber the logging companies could take each year. The case, National Resources Defense Council v. United States Forest Service, was argued in early 2005 and stems from a 1999 legal challenge to the Forest Service, according to court findings. Six environmental groups joined in the suit: the National Resources Defense Council, Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, the Wilderness Society, the Center for Biological Diversity, and Sierra Club and Earth Justice, the nonprofit environmental law firm which argued the case. The groups are calling for a moratorium on new logging until a fresh plan is worked out. The Alaskan District Court will decide whether to prohibit logging while the Forest Service revises the land management plan. These brief reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Every 8 years, every radio and TV station in the country must apply to the Federal Communications Commission for renewal of its broadcast license. The process provides an opportunity for those concerned about the quality of their local media to talk directly to the FCC about their concerns. Karen Hennane, a lawyer with Georgetown University's Institute for Public Representation, says one of the little-known ways every local broadcast outlet must serve the public interest is by keeping a public file.
You can access the public file during regular business hours without delay. And if they turn you away and say, come back in an hour, they're acting improperly. If they say, come back tomorrow, we just don't have someone to show it to you, they are acting improperly. If they say, you can't Xerox it, they are acting improperly. My one note on the Xeroxing, they can ask you to pay a reasonable fee for getting pieces of the public file Xeroxed, but they cannot tell you no.
By law, a station's public file must contain several types of documents, including the station's actual license and any related correspondence with the FCC, the last 3 years of written public comment received by the station, and a limited amount of financial information. The public file should also include what Hanane calls an issues and programs list, which is supposed to be an inventory of programming that provides significant treatment of community issues.
Often, it'll be a mess. It'll be a bunch of scraps of paper in a lot of different people's offices, but be persistent and try to get it. They also don't have to organize it in any particular form. Some stations that are really organized will have maybe a page for environmental issues, a page for political issues, a page for international or national, but most of them really don't go that far.
An incomplete public file is a major violation of FCC rules, and the agency is much more likely to take any infraction seriously during the station license renewal process. However, public inspections of a station's public file are incredibly rare because the public doesn't know it has the right to hold local stations accountable. One place where media watchdogs do exist is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. There, the Grand Rapids Institute for Information Democracy keeps tabs on local television news coverage, according to grid director Jeff Smith.
We watch 4 hours of local TV news every day. We do all the stations that are broadcast in our area so we can methodically look at how much election coverage, how they're covering the war, how they're covering race, gender, class issues, how are they covering trade policies, what are they doing about crime and the environment, public schools, all those kinds of things.
This media tracking comes in especially handy when local stations apply to renew their FCC licenses. All TV stations in Michigan must renew their licenses this year, and Jeff says their springtime inventory of local news programming does not reflect well on their local stations.
It does not provide any information for people to make decisions. We had 174 municipal school board elections in our market. We only had 4 election stories for the entire market, and they only focused on one of those municipalities. Otherwise, the rest of them, too bad. But we got 84 Michael Jackson trial stories. We got, you know, over 100 Terri Schiavo stories. We got over 100 stories about the Pope on local TV news.
The FCC is not likely to deny a station its license renewal just because of public feedback, but no station owner likes to build up a negative record in their public file or with the FCC. Most TV and radio stations aren't used to having their licenses challenged, and such feedback might pressure stations to pay closer attention to sentiments in the communities they serve. Organizing locally to challenge broadcast license renewals is also an excellent method for raising awareness among the public on media issues.
And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. Researchers at Sonoma State University just finished an analysis of the boards of directors of the 10 largest media companies in America and found that they share a lot in common. A combined 118 people sit on all 10 boards of directors. In fact, 8 of the 10 companies share common board members. These 118 also happen to sit on the boards of nearly 300 other multinational corporations. The analysis suggests that the interlocking nature between the boards of directors at media companies and those at other corporations may explain why news with a corporate-friendly spin is becoming increasingly the norm at major newspapers and radio and TV networks. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature a truth track, an audio documentary which hopes to rock hard as it seeks to inform, educate, and inspire. This week's truth track is entitled, The Possible Future of Video on the Internet. In the world of independent video distribution, some very new intriguing developments are coming to the fore, many of which combine video and the internet, and could provide some new tools which could help independent video producers expand their outreach. Some proposed distribution mechanisms are not all that different from what is happening now with internet-propelled audio broadcasts. One such development is what's termed podcasting, a combination of audio files and syndication software tools to distribute audio content across the internet and onto portable MP3 players like Apple's vaunted iPod, hence the name podcasting. One example of a video internet combination is that of online video weblogs, termed with the unsexy sounding word vlog. But as podcasting has taken off just a year after its advent, so too could vlogging. Another high-flying technology combining the internet and video is BitTorrent, a means of quickly downloading incredibly large files, including large digital video files. The success of BitTorrent can't be exaggerated. In just 2 years since being invented, BitTorrent files consume nearly 40% of all internet traffic. And all kinds of TV shows and movies have been converted into BitTorrent files, often without commercials, and often distributed on illegal terms. Needless to say, that has big media companies furious and scared. One CBS executive estimated that big media have just 10 years to defuse the threat to conventional broadcast media posed by BitTorrent. But BitTorrent could just be the beginning. There are more video and internet tools on the way. Some of the most innovative projects have been coming from a music and activist organization known as Downhill Battle, which have been building a simplified version of BitTorrent called BlogTorrent, and other tools under the label Participatory Culture to create entire internet-powered TV channels. That, coupled with increasingly fast internet speeds, could make for some interesting prospects for community and grassroots video and TV. But advanced technologies and making quality content with those technologies will not guarantee that the internet will remain a free medium and avoid becoming a restricted medium like commercial radio and TV broadcasting. The fight to keep the internet as a free and open medium encompasses a struggle in the political sphere as well. That struggle has seen mixed results in 2005. Community internet initiatives have been squashed by big cable and telecommunications companies in more than a dozen state legislatures. But political fights in another 7 states, including Illinois and Texas, have proven successful in fending off big media efforts to limit community internet. But the struggle has also extended to the federal level. In 2005, competing bills were introduced which would alternately kill or liberate proposed community internet initiatives. Plus, there's also a proposed rewrite of the major communications law in America, the Telecommunications Act. The last time such a law was passed was in 1996, and it was expected to last more than 60 years. But the internet changed the media equation dramatically, and a rewrite is being proposed just after 9 years. And if passed in its initial form, the Telecommunications Act rewrite would dramatically curtail much of the freedom currently in the internet. Then there's the Supreme Court. On the same day that file-sharing networks got slammed in a 2005 Supreme Court ruling for illegally distributing audio content, which could extend to their video content cousins, there was the Brand X case. In this case, an internet service provider called Brand X sued the FCC over a rule restricting cable connections for distributing internet content. Brand X lost the case, and despite an FCC rule change responding to the court, which wasn't as bad as initially feared, we may all wind up losers, not just Brand X. So, in a nutshell, that's the lay of the land for the future of video on the internet. What's going to happen? That's for each of us to determine. But take heart, we have seen some pretty impressive media politics victories in recent years. And struggles can build off of one another. Some of the free media still available can make an impact in the political sphere. You've just consumed some free media right now. Let's continue working to keep it free. This concludes this Truth Track. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.